Phillips, and I should note, or will note, that Judge Stuckey will be participating on the record. That's true of the next case as well, but I'll say it then. Counsel for the appellant, are you ready to proceed?
Yes, sir.
Thank you.
Chief Judge Baker, members of the court, I'm Captain Patrick Crocker, and Lieutenant Colonel Jonathan Potter and I represent the appellant, Private Bryce Phillips. CARE and RCM 910 state that a plea cannot be truly voluntary unless the defendant possesses an understanding of the law in relation to the facts and understands the nature of the offense to which a plea is offered. Private Phillips, in this case, was not provident to his plea to willful disobedience because he did not understand the nature of Article 90 or how the ultimate offense doctrine applied to the facts in this case. The ultimate offense for the additional charge was restriction-breaking and not willful disobedience. The scheme of crime and punishment established by Congress and the President through Articles 90, 91, 92, 95, and various specified articles under 134 for especially restriction-breaking is eroded by the Army Court's en banc decision below and should be reversed. I'll start with a little bit of a historical perspective. The broad spectrum of order violation offenses are basically bookended by Article 9.
Can I just ask a threshold question? You're here asking us to determine whether there's a substantial basis in law or fact to find the plea improvident. Is that correct?
That's correct.
So that's the threshold thing. So you're now going to explain to us what that substantial basis is?
Yes, Your Honor. Yes. So Article 90 and Article 134 for restriction breaking essentially bookend the orders violation offenses within the code. The former is punishable by death in a time of war or up to 5 years and a dishonorable discharge versus just 1 month, two-thirds forfeitures, and no punitive discharge for restriction breaking. The President, through various acts, has historically regarded a violation of restriction as a minor offense. And that's evidenced by the existence of restriction breaking.
Do you agree with the CCA's characterization that either offense could have been charged here?
I do, Your Honor, and that's part of the issue.
So the Article 134, the Article 90, but I take it then you don't agree with the CCA's characterization that it's not for them to determine which charge, as between two available charges, the government should have proceeded with?
I don't take issue with that particular statement by the court because the court shouldn't decide what the government charges, but what the government charges they should prove, and what the government charges in the context of a providence inquiry should be understood by the appellant and should be that the facts necessary to support that plea should be called out by the military judge. What I do take issue with, and I think the real issue, is that the Army Court says it doesn't matter. They say that the distinction between Article 90 and Article 134 doesn't matter and doesn't need to be understood by the appellant when they're pleading guilty.
But if both charges are available, I take it then your view is that the military judge in a CARE inquiry, at least in the context of your case, is required to explain to an appellant or the accused at that point all the different ways the government might have charged the case. Is that essentially what you're saying? Because you're not saying it's a defense.
No, Your Honor.
And you're not saying it's a matter inconsistent. So I think what you're saying is the military judge during the CARE inquiry has to give an essay on all the different ways the thing could have been charged.
No, Your Honor, I don't think an essay is required. What needs to be discussed with the accused is essentially the ultimate offense doctrine. And in Lewes in 1954, Justice Latimer, in concurrence, sort of raised the same issue. And what he suggested was...
But under what theory does that have to be explained to the appellant? Isn't that the role of defense counsel?
Your Honor, the theory is under RCM 910 and under a CARE inquiry that... An accused has to understand the nature of the charge to which he's pleading.
Why not just say here are the elements of Article 90 and do the normal CARE inquiry? You're saying no, we have to go into footnote 5 and talk about a charge that wasn't presented. And I'm trying to ask, what is the substantial basis in law for requiring, why does the military judge have to do that?
The military judge has to do that specifically in this case because during cases of Article 90 offenses versus minor offenses under 134, because, as the Army Court acknowledges, the exact same fact pattern can support both charges. And they one is not a lesser included offense of the other. So when the same fact pattern can form the basis of...
Did you bring in ineffective assistance of counsel? Did you allege ineffective assistance of counsel?
No, Your Honor, we did not.
Okay, but this was a guilty plea case, correct?
It was a guilty plea, yes, Your Honor.
And he could have not entered a guilty plea to the Article 90 offense, correct?
The option is always there to negotiate the plea.
And the defense counsel, presumably, under your theory, could have approached the convening authority and explained to him why he needed to make a different charge than he chose to make?
They could have argued that as a matter of clemency under 11.
But none of that happened, did it?
No, ma'am. No, it did not.
Just to understand where you're headed with this, which is, so if this was a case where someone had been killed and the government charges it as voluntary manslaughter, does the military judge have to explain that they might have charged it as premeditated murder or involuntary manslaughter?
No, Your Honor. And that's what makes these types of cases unique when you talk about orders violation offenses. If you look at the elements of Article 90 and compare that to the elements of Article 134, it's clear that the same fact pattern can support a finding of guilt of both. It's the nature of the offense that's different. Article 90 is focused on that superior officer and on their authority as an officer and holding their office. Article 134 is focused on the object of the order, not the authority of the officer giving the order. So they're distinct in that regard. And when the punishment for one is 60 times greater than the punishment for the other, the accused, when he comes in to do a guilty plea, needs to understand that distinction. And that distinction, the court has created the ultimate offense doctrine in order to delineate and draw a line between offenses that fall within the very serious crime of Article 90 and the minor offense of Article 134. RCM 304 gives the best indication of how the president views restriction breaking in the scope of orders violation types offenses.
So, counsel,
yes.
Building on your argument right now, what would be the broad-based rule you would want this court to come up with in our decision in this case? Something that is not tailored narrowly to this case, but the broad-based rule about when we would impose additional burdens on the military judge.
Yes, Your Honor. The clearest the clearest rule that would provide the best guidance to lower courts and to military judges would be to consider the ultimate offense doctrine to be essentially an element or an essential fact that needs to be discussed with an accused during a providence inquiry, and that would also need to be submitted potentially to a trier of fact, or at least be decided by a military judge as an issue, the same way that lawfulness of an order is determined.
So you're narrowing this to ultimate offense doctrine. You're not looking for any broader rule than that?
Your Honor, no. Not
now, what if the military judge were to say to defense counsel, counsel, did you discuss the ultimate offense doctrine with your client? And defense counsel were to say, yes, Your Honor. Would that be sufficient inquiry?
It would certainly go to putting something on the record that the issue had been discussed.
Okay, so. But put something on the record that's clear. But would that be sufficient?
I would say it would not be sufficient, Your Honor, because what CARE and what RCM 910 requires is that the accused themselves understand the nature of the offense and understand how the law applies to the facts. Not that the law has just been discussed with them, but that they are voluntarily pleading because they understand that they're guilty and that they know what they're pleading to.
And the burden is... I'm sorry, Judge Ryan.
Go ahead.
You're still on.
So the burden is on the military judge alone to... determine that the ultimate offense doctrine is at play in a particular case?
The military judge, just like with any other aspect of a providence inquiry, is their obligation to ensure that the plea comes across so that the accused knowingly is pleading guilty because they know that they're guilty and understands the nature of the charge. In this case, the joint appendix at page 33, He asked Private Phillips if he understood the command. In fact, he asked him that twice. And he also asked him if he believed the command was lawful. Now, neither of those things are elements, but they are essential facts that need to be understood by an appellant when they're pleading guilty to this type of crime. So the ultimate offense doctrine is similar to these types of questions. It's something that the military judge needs to get at so that we can ensure that the accused understands that they're pleading guilty to a very serious crime as opposed to a minor offense.
Judge Ryan, then...
Go ahead.
So, you're good?
Yeah.
No, go ahead.
Okay. The developmental counseling form wasn't introduced into evidence, but it's in the record. Is that something we can look at?
Your Honor, it wasn't introduced into evidence, so if this court... No, this is not a context where something that is just within the pretrial allied papers should be considered by the court. This court should consider just what was entered into evidence.
Is your position premised ultimately on the fact that, in your view, the ultimate offense or the gravamen of the offense here was breaking restriction?
That is one of the theories that we're arguing, yes, Your Honor. I think that the most prevalent and salient issue before the court is whether or not the ultimate offense doctrine is something that needs to be discussed with an accused so that they understand what the nature of the offense is that they're pleading to.
And would that be true even if we were to determine that the gravamen of the offense here was in fact disobedience of an order from a commissioned officer?
If the gravamen of the offense, if this court determines that the ultimate offense was an Article 90, there's still the requirement that Private Phillips understand that. But I don't think this court.
I understand that's not your position. I'm not trying to trick you into saying that's your position. I just want to understand. So what happens if in fact someone is a serial restriction breaker, and they're doing their weekly restriction breaking? They just pile up, they're reduced to E1, they take away they do the forfeiture, and you can only forfeit once, right? Because you got to pay the person something, such as a PATS. You can break restriction as many times as you want.
No, Your Honor, it's not. And the restriction breaking is not a crime that is always going to fall under 134, because there are certain types of restriction breaking, serial offenders or offenders that where multiple orders are given or even one subsequent order is given.
Why isn't this a case of serial offense? There can't be anything quite as clear to an infantry person as going before your company commander and being counseled both in writing and orally to knock it off, especially when you've been on two extended periods of AWOL or desertion, one of them leading to your arrest for showing your private parts to children. You don't think the company commander is trying to tell him not to take this seriously, that this is an order from your company commander? This is not just about breaking restriction?
Your Honor, what's at issue specifically is that he was only charged with one incidence of restriction breaking, and he was only given one order. So there are two, United States versus Henderson is the test that controls. That's the three-part test that looks at the nature of the order, the source and content of the order, and then the nature of the disobedience. This is a case where one order is given. It is given personally, which the lower court paid a lot of attention to. However, orders imposing restriction come personally from company commanders all the time. That is company commander business. That's how they do business. And so it's routine for them to give personal orders imposing restriction, imposing no contact orders, or imposing any number of other orders upon people. The authority under which they give, they impose a restriction comes from Article 9 and Article 10 of the UCMJ. And the President under Article 36 is allowed to promulgate rules and procedures for the imposition of pretrial restraint. He does so in RCM 304. Now, under 304 in the discussion section and the forerunner to RCM 304, paragraph 20B in the 1968 MCM, both indicate that the President views a violation of restriction as a violation of Article 92, 95, or 134 for restriction breaking, not Article 90. So the presumption is that there's an Article 90. And that's what the ultimate offense doctrine gets at, especially with a minor offense that concerns breaking restriction. What it wants to look at is, were there multiple orders given? Was there something done by that company commander to raise that order above the common rock and for him to put the full weight and authority of his office behind that order? Here we have one order, so that takes it out of the realm of the number of cases that precede this one that concern an order reinforcing a pre-existing duty or reinforcing...
Well, Rainey focused on the fact that the order was given in person. How do you deal with Rainey?
With regard to the order given in person, the ultimate decision in Rainey, I believe, was that Article 90 was not appropriate. It was given not in person, Your Honor. If I recall, it was given through a memorandum signed by the general at the time imposing the driving restrictions.
I may have the wrong case. Anyway.
Yes, Your Honor. There are a number of orders that have been given personally. I would direct this court's attention.
So what would this company commander have had to do, in your view, to make it a 90 situation rather than a breaking restriction situation?
It is difficult for a company commander, and just factually, it's difficult for a company commander on a first order imposing restriction to raise his order above the common rock, because imposition of restriction is a fairly routine order that is usually given in person. Normally, it would be a second order.
So an infantry company commander has to give two orders in order to command his company?
He does not have to, Your Honor. He would need to make it clear within the context of the order, or it would need to come out on the record during a Providence inquiry that Private Phillips understood that order was given with the full weight and authority of his office. If this court would look at Joint Appendix page 31, the military judge says, "Tell me in your own words why you are guilty of willfully disobeying a superior commissioned officer." Now, it's important what the accused says, because the accused does not talk about the office of his commander. He does not talk about flagrantly defying that office or directly flouting the authority of his commander. He talks about the object of the order. He says, because I was residing off post when I was clearly given a command to stay on post and not break restriction. He's focused on the object of the order. He thinks that's why he's pleading guilty to Article 9.
Counsel, as you're mentioning, he pled guilty. So why wasn't this waived? It was unconditional guilty plea, waived all waivable motions. He received a benefit from this guilty plea. Why wasn't this waived?
Your Honor, because waiver of due process and waiver of making a voluntary guilty plea in accordance with RCM 910 is not possible.
But you can waive an objection to a charging decision, right? So, for example, let's say he'd been charged with both Article 134 and Article 90, and he pleaded guilty to both of them, right? And then he came up and said, I waive all waivable motions, and then came up and said, you should dismiss one because they're multiplicious. Wouldn't that be waived?
Your Honor, I see I'm out of time. May I answer?
Yes.
I'm sorry. Yes. And in this case, the answer to your question is yes, that can be waived. In this case, it was not. There was a waive all waivable motions portion of the pretrial agreement that was discussed at length on the record by the military judge, and what they discussed was what was being waived was Article 13 type issues. So this particular ultimate offense doctrine issue was never raised as something that was contemplated being waived.
But you would agree that we would have to agree with you that the ultimate offense doctrine has to be explained on the record, even if we feel that this is an orders violation?
Yes, Your Honor. It would still need to be explained to the accused. The accused needs to understand why he's pleading guilty.
Right, but what I'm saying is, if we disagree with you that needed to be explained, then it would be waived.
No, Your Honor, it would not be waived, because during the discussion by the military judge with defense counsel about what waive all waivable motions means, ultimate offense was never brought up. There were other issues that were discussed, but it was not a knowing and voluntary waiver, because it wasn't discussed with defense counsel on the record by the military judge.
Meaning the facts of this case. In another case, if you say I waive all waivable motions, you're saying you might have waived it. But in this case, the judge said you're waiving 1, 2, 3, therefore 4 is not waived.
Yes, Your Honor.
But in another case, if you don't mention any of the numbers, you're waiving them all. Potentially.
Okay. Yes, Your Honor.
You have time on rebuttal, if you'd like.
Yes, sir.
All right, counsel for the government.
Thank you. Chief Judge Baker, members of the court, may it please the court. My name is Captain Daniel.
Can you hear in the back, please? Okay, sorry.
My name is Captain Daniel Goldberg, and I, with Major Daniel Derner, represent the government in this matter today. We ask that you affirm the Article 90 conviction because appellant was provident and there is no substantial basis to reverse. As a preliminary matter, although questions of providence can never be waived, any claim that willful disobedience is not the ultimate offense is waived because the claim is factual and does not address jurisdiction or due process. Appellant pled guilty and expressly agreed to waive all waivable motions. Therefore, his assertions not having to do with providence are waived. Next, appellant demonstrated providence.
Just to be clear then, there's a distinction between knowing you can waive, as Judge Ryan's question suggested, you can waive a disagreement with the charge, but you can't ever waive the fact that you're knowingly and intelligently pleading. Is that correct?
That is correct, Your Honor.
And then you get into debate. Where's that line? But
yes, Your Honor.
Okay.
Yes, Your Honor. In Gladue, of course, UMC and multiplicity were waived. And those were charging decisions, much like the question whether to charge Article 134 or Article 90. Appellant demonstrated his providence to the Article 90 charge, and there is no substantial basis to reverse. The judge correctly defined each of the four Article 90 elements, and then appellant affirmed that each element applied to him. Appellant also understood that his commander used the full authority of his office. When defining the lawfulness element, the military judge explained that the order must be given for a reason other than to increase punishment, and that it must be directed personally to appellant. Practically speaking, this is how Lewis defined lifting an order above the common run. Making an order directly personal is how a commander supports a routine duty with the full authority of his office. Appellant was provident to the fact that the order was directed personally to him and that it was unambiguous. He told the judge that his commander clearly gave him a command to stay on post. The record also reflects that, like the commander in Traxler, appellant's commander personally conveyed the command in writing and had appellant sign it. The military judge correctly explained the elements to Article 90, and appellant demonstrated that he was provident. Therefore, there is no substantial basis to overturn appellant's guilty plea to Article 90. Pending any questions.
Do you agree with the defense that the consuling form that contains the order that we're discussing here is not properly before this court?
I do agree, Your Honor. It's not part of the record. It was never entered into evidence, so it is not. If there are no further questions, the government has nothing further.
Thank you, counsel. Counsel for the appellant, you're probably, are you ready?
Yes, Your Honor, very briefly. With regard to the personal nature of the order, I direct this court's attention to its prior decisions in Wurzbach, 1972, Nixon, 1972, Peaches, Byers, Ranney. These are all instances where a personal order was given, and that's not dispositive of whether or not the issue is, or the order raised, is raised above the common law. In fact, in Wurzbach, the captain in that case personally ordered the appellant to remove a silver bracelet that he had on. Appellant said, "I refuse, add it to the rest of the charges," and this was done in front of other soldiers. That was held not to be an Article 90 violation.
Should we, is the common ruck test a sound one, or should we be looking at the gravamonte of the offense?
I think they both go to the same issue, Your Honor. In Lewes, what they were doing, the common ruck test or the rise above the common ruck test was created as an exception to the footnote 5.
Can you define in plain English common ruck?
Common ruck. The better description or the better definition that's given is generally whether the officer put the full weight and authority of his office behind the order. Above the common ruck, I think, just means above the common orders and common issues that present themselves before a commander. For example, as the government mentioned in Traxler and in Brownlow, two cases from 94, that both of those cases were commanders ordering someone to deploy. So the nature of the order is significant. It is not a minor issue of restriction. It is a major issue of deploying to a combat zone. And in one of those cases in Traxler, the order was given multiple times, and the last time was given in writing and received on the flight line in view of all the other soldiers from the unit that were deploying. That's an Article 90 violation. That is what Article 90 is getting at. It's not getting at the commonplace imposition of restriction and the violation of that restriction because a soldier wants to go visit his girlfriend. which is what we have here. So the personal nature of the order is not dispositive. I urge this court to look at Henderson and apply that test, especially the third prong, the nature of the disobedience, and to see that when he pled guilty, and when they said, why do you think you're guilty, he was talking about violating the object of the order and not offending the office of his commander.
Counsel, I just want to be clear here. It seems to me from your argument the issue here is not whether the ultimate offense doctrine was triggered, but whether the military judge erred in not explaining it.
Your Honor, I'm arguing both. My primary argument is that the ultimate offense doctrine needs to be discussed with an accused during providence. The alternate argument is that he just was not provident to Article 90. There aren't enough facts on the record to support a plea based on what he tells the military judge during the plea colloquy. So they're two separate arguments. But the primary argument, I think, is the one that is going to give lower courts the clearest direction in terms of what they need to do from here on out when confronted with this issue in the context of the difference. Any other questions?
Okay. Thank you, counsel. We thank both counsel, and I'm trying to see the clock, but I can't see it. We'll stand in recess until 5 past the hour. Thank you very much.
All rise. Court stands in recess until 10:05.